My name's John Lyon. I'm the Fitzgerald Professor of Accounting here at University of Melbourne. Usually the introduction to this lecture is undertaken by our Dean, Margaret Abernathy, but unfortunately she's been called away tonight on a couple of matters, and so she's asked me to stand in for her. So I'd like to firstly welcome everybody to the 70th annual CPA Australia University of Melbourne Research Lecture. As many of you are aware, this has been going continuously now for 70 years. It's the longest, certainly the longest lecture series in Australia, in accounting in Australia, and undoubtedly the longest lecture series in accounting in the world. Tonight, we have a speaker who we are very honoured to have here. That is Professor Mary Barth. Mary Barth is the Joan Horngren Professor of Accounting and the Bob and Marilyn Jadicke Faculty Fellow at Stanford University in the Graduate School of Business. As some of you are aware, Mary's a past member of the International Accounting Standards Board, and she served on the IASB from its inception in 2001 until this year, and has since taken on the role as academic advisor to the IASB. Prior to joining the IASB, Mary's accounting standard setting activities included serving as a member of the Accounting Standards Executive Committee of the American Institute of CPAs and the Financial Accounting Standards Advisory Council of the FASB. Prior to joining the faculty at Stanford in 1995, she was an associate professor at Harvard Business School and an audit partner at Arthur Andersen and Company. Professor Barth, of course, has a very distinguished research career. Her research focus is in financial accounting and reporting issues, particularly those topics of interest to accounting standard setters. Her research has been published in the leading accounting academic journals, and she's won several prestigious awards for this research. These include the Wildman Medal. The Wildman Medal is awarded by the American Accounting Association. She's been awarded this twice, and it's awarded for excellence in accounting research. She's also won the American Accounting Association's Best Paper Award in Financial Accounting and Reporting twice, and has also won the American Accounting Association's Competitive Manuscript Award. And so Mary has a very long career, a very checkered career, prestigious career in the research field of financial accounting and reporting. Mary is past associate editor of the Accounting Review and, of course, continues to serve on various editorial boards for several leading academic journals. Mary also has a distinguished career in teaching. She's a recipient of Stanford Business School's MBA Distinguished Teaching Award and the PhD Faculty Distinguished Service Award. She has also had teaching awards recognised internationally from the American Accounting Association as Outstanding International Accounting Educator. Apart from Mary's continued service to the ASB, she remains active in the American Accounting Association, having served as past vice president, and remains chair of several American Accounting Association committees. Professor Barth holds an undergraduate degree from Cornell, an MBA from Boston University, PhD from Stanford University, and an honorary doctorate of science from Lancaster University. So, on that note, I'd like to you to join me in welcoming Mary Barth to please present the 70th annual CPA University of Melbourne Research Lecture. Professor Barth.
Thank you, John, for that very nice introduction, and thank you all for coming here this evening. It really is my great honor to be here to deliver the 70th annual research lecture. I'm delighted that the University of Melbourne and CPA Australia has invited me to address you this evening on what is really my favorite topic, as you can tell from John's introduction, and that is accounting research and global financial reporting issues. What I plan to do this evening the time that I have is talk a little bit about the relation between academic research and standard setting issues. And I'm going to do that in the context of fair value accounting, give you some examples of research there, and talk a little bit about research related to the globalization of financial reporting. I'm going to close with a few comments about the current financial crisis. I believe research can inform the standard setting process for a variety of reasons. First of all, accounting research helps standard setters identify the issues that they really should be grappling with. Sometimes standard setters have an idea of what the issue is, but academics can help them sort through that and figure out what the underlying issue really is. Once they identify the issue, academics research can also help structure their thinking about the issue so that they make good decisions at the end of the day. And of course, we also provide evidence related to some of the issues that they're talking about, and I'm going to give you some examples of those this evening. Research also provides unbiased analysis to standard setters. Academics are among the few groups who have no vested interest in the outcome of any standard setting decisions. If you think about it, companies care because they report the numbers according to the standards, so they have an interest in how they come out. Auditors have to audit the information, so they care about how they come out. Analysts use the information. They want information that they want. Academics just want to tell it like it is, and that's very helpful to standard setters. The other thing is that concepts underlying financial reporting are very comfortable for academic researchers. Academic researchers are trained in economics, particularly information economics, the role of information in capital markets, and they bring this knowledge to their research. And those are exactly the same concepts that underlie the framework for financial reporting that we use in standard setting. There's been debate among academics for a long time about the extent to which academic research really can inform the standard setting process. Back in 1974, Gonides and Dopich wrote a paper, a very influential paper, that explained that accounting standards are public goods and involve externalities. And as a result, you can't determine the desirability of any particular accounting standard simply by looking at the relation, for example, between share prices and accounting amounts, that determining the desirability of any particular standard requires specifying social preferences and trade-offs, the winners and the losers. And thus, even with market efficiency, if we had true market efficiency, the relation between equity prices and returns and accounting amounts is really not sufficient to determine the desirability of a particular accounting standard. As a result, researchers have come to accept this. Everything Gonides and Dopich said was true. And therefore, we take a different tack to try to relate research to standard setting issues, different from trying to identify what should the standard be. As a result, what academic researchers often do is turn to the framework that underlies financial reporting, and operationalize the criteria that are specified in the framework. The standard setters have set out the framework and specified what is important to them in making standard setting decisions, and therefore academic researchers can come along and take those criteria, operationalize them in their research design, and then provide input to the standard setters as to how particular aspects of questions embody those criteria. As a result, it's important to acknowledge the standard setters set the rules. The researchers are not trying to figure out, as I said, what the standard setters should do. Research informs standard setting. It's important to keep this in mind. But it cannot answer the question, what should the standard be? So don't look for that in academic research. We know better than to say that. But what that also means is the questions motivating the research, what I call the motivating questions, are different from the actual research question that is addressed in the research study. The research question is the question the researcher poses that they can answer. Can't answer the motivating questions. Motivating questions often are what should the standard be, and therefore these two differ. And I'm going to give you some examples tonight of studies that I've been involved in to explain to you how I think about the difference between the motivating question in those studies and the research questions, so hopefully you'll understand what I'm trying to get at here. Often people ask, what about research topics? What research topics are of interest to standard setters? And the good news for researchers is that there is no end to the questions that we do not know the answers to. There are technical agenda topics, and I'll show you the ISB's agenda in a moment. All these items are on the agenda because we don't know the answer to the questions, and therefore there's plenty of room for academics to provide input. There are also cross-cutting issues, at least that's a term the standard setters use, issues that pervade topics, that go across topics. Fair value, recognition versus disclosure, the role of uncertainty and risk, relevance and faithful representation, are they complements, substitutes, are there trade-offs? The role of incentives and judgment in financial reporting, the distinction between liabilities and equity, user needs, what are user needs after all? That's what standard setters are supposed to be serving. And costs and benefits. What are the costs and benefits involved in various standards? The FASB and the IASB have a joint project right now to revisit the conceptual framework. And anytime you use the word conceptual, people immediately think of academics. So I think academic research can probably help us figure out whether we've got the right framework or what needs to be changed or help us fill in the holes in the framework. So the conceptual framework also provides an area where academic research can help. And then the other topic I'm going to talk a few minutes about this evening, as I mentioned, is the globalization of financial reporting itself. The first three of these bullets talk really about the technical aspects of financial reporting. But the other thing, as we all know, that's been happening around the world in the last 10 years is the globalization of financial reporting. Countries like Australia adopting international financial reporting standards as their own to achieve hopefully certain benefits, and the research looking into some of those questions is a growing area of research where academics can help. The first topic, as I said, I want to talk a bit about is fair value. Fair value is one of these cross-cutting issues. It pervades almost everything we do. It's current focus of the FASB and the IASB in their joint projects. And there's a growing academic literature. There's a lot of academic literature out there now, and I'll summarize some of that for you. But it's a place where I believe academics can help contribute to the debate. This is the current IASB agenda, and I don't plan to go through all of these topics. But if you just look at it, it's almost everything you've ever thought of in financial reporting. As an academic researcher, if you can't find a topic here of interest to you, then you must be in the wrong line of business, because this is just about everything we know. The question is, which of those projects deals with fair value? And the short answer is almost all of them. It seems that the IASB considers fair value measurement whenever measurement is an issue in a standard. And if you think about what accountants do, that's almost all the time. Every once in a while, we have disclosure-only standards, for example, or the framework, but most of the time, we're trying to figure out how something should be measured in the financial statements. And whenever that's on the table, then fair value is considered. So some of the current projects that are focused on measurement include, obviously, fair value measurement. This is a project to define what fair value means. The conceptual framework, the current framework really has not a lot of specifics about making measurement decisions. And the boards are developing an entire chapter on measurement. Financial instruments, non-financial liabilities, pensions, and right now looking at contribution-based promises, maybe even for defined benefit plan promises when the boards take up the full project in some years from now. But it's not just limited to these. Revenue, insurance, leases, again, just about everywhere we look. Why is it that the standard setters often look to fair value as a possible measurement objective? Well, first and foremost, I believe, it's because it's consistent with the objective of financial reporting, as specified in the framework. That objective is to provide users of financial statements with information that assists them in making economic decisions, including predicting amounts, timing, and uncertainty of cash flows. Well, fair values are nothing more than the present value of expected future cash flows. And the discount rate reflects the uncertainty that are inherent in those cash flows. So if we're trying to provide users with this type of information, fair value is on the list. It doesn't mean it is the right one. Doesn't mean it is the one that should be picked, but it should be on the list to be considered. Fair value, I believe, is also consistent with the definitions of assets and liabilities. Both of those definitions focus on the future, future inflows in the case of assets and future outflows in the case of liabilities. Again, it suggests a current measure, and therefore fair value should be on the list. Both of these suggest current amounts based on expectations of the future, adjusted for the time value of money and risk. And another reason fair value is often on the list is that it provides an unbiased view of the entity's assets and liabilities at the reporting date. Oftentimes, management wants to shade numbers one way or the other, most of the time to be more optimistic. And fair value says, no, take a market participant view, which is aimed at being an unbiased view. I also believe fair value possesses many of the qualitative characteristics of accounting information that are specified in the framework. Relevant says it's capable of helping users make decisions. Again, it seems that a current measure of something will help be more relevant to users making decisions today than, for example, some modified historical cost number that's 20 years old. Faithful representation suggests a current measure of assets and liabilities. If you're trying to faithfully represent an asset or a liability at the financial statement date, it seems that you should consider a current measure of that amount. Comparability says that like things should look alike and different things should look different. So comparability suggests you want the same measures for like items that are held by different entities. Fair value also meets that bill. I could go on. Neutrality, predictive ability. Fair value also captures economic mismatches. The mixed attribute model that we have today actually masks some of these economic mismatches and creates accounting mismatches, which is why we have hedge accounting to begin with. And therefore, it's attractive to think about a measurement basis that would avoid some of those. That's some of the good news, at least for the advocates of fair value. But others say, wait a second, no, fair value is actually not a good idea. Not everyone believes it's the best thing to do. And why is that? Many of them are concerned about estimation error, particularly for non-traded instruments, and therefore there's scope for managing estimates of fair value. Of course, the people on the other side would say, but estimates pervade financial reporting. Almost every number we have in the financial statements requires judgment to determine. Fair value, on the other hand, puts a market discipline on the estimation, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that helps rein things in. And after a while, hopefully, guidance, like the Fair Value Measurement Project, added disclosures and education should mitigate some of this. Others are concerned about recognizing holding gains and losses in earnings. View it as an opportunity cost approach to financial reporting that they don't think is appropriate. And they fear users won't understand the numbers. Maybe users' models are designed to cope with the measures we currently report, and we take a different view on how financial reporting is done. They'll be confused, and that will lead to confusion in the markets, the very markets that we're trying to help. Others think there's too much earnings volatility. I think it's pretty clear if we did more fair values in financial reporting, there would be more earnings volatility. When earnings volatility becomes too much is a question that I don't have the answer to, but that's what some people are concerned about. And actually, in the current crisis, the concern about fair values goes beyond all of these and talks about liquidity effects, pro-cyclicality, and the effects on bank capital. Just be sure we're all speaking the same language. As you know, the ISB has a project, a fair value measurement project, to define fair value. It doesn't require any more fair value than we currently have, but it says when we use this term, fair value, what do we mean? So I just want to clarify it for us this evening, at least what I mean when I say it. Fair value is an exit price from the perspective of the entity. It's the price that would be received to sell an asset or paid to transfer a liability in an orderly transaction between market participants at the measurement date. So it's a current amount, an exit price. Sell an asset, transfer a liability. You have the asset, you have the liability. The only thing you can do is get rid of it. And this says, what would the price be? Fair value assumes either a sale or use in a business, both based on a market participant perspective. So it's not a liquidation notion. Just the fact that the entity is going to use the asset and not sell it is not a reason to not use fair value, because it's defined both as sale or in use. Sometimes people talk past each other when they talk about exit value and entry value, and they think that this is part of the debate, and it depends on how you define those terms. But the way those terms are defined in the fair value measurement project is that entry and exit prices will be the same for the same asset or liability, the same item, on the same date, in the same market, and buyers and sellers have the same information. So we're taking transaction costs off the table. That's a different conversation. So entry and exit is not buying wholesale, selling retail. Those are different assets, different markets. Exit and entry will be the same. Same item, same date, same market, same information. It can be different in different markets, and the document says to look to the most advantageous market. Okay, so that's what fair value is and why we might use it. I'm going to give you the examples of two of my research papers on fair value, not because I'm the only one that does it, not because mine are better than anybody else's. It's just that I'm familiar with them, and it's easier for me to explain to you the thought process behind the papers and how I think about the motivating question, research question, the findings, and the interpretation of them. The first example that I'm going to go through with you this evening has to do with fair value accounting for liabilities and own credit risk. Joint work with Leslie Hodder at the University of Indiana and Steve Steuben at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. As you know, fair value accounting for liabilities and the effects of own credit risk is highly controversial, and we tackle this problem in this paper. In this paper, the motivating question is, do changes in credit risk affect a fair value of liability? Many people don't think credit risk changes should be reflected in fair value. The second question is, if we were to recognize these numbers, would net income be misleading? The concern here is that when a company's financial condition deteriorates, their credit risk goes up, the value of their liabilities goes down. We're a room full of accountants. We know what happens when liabilities go down. Debit liabilities, credit something, credit income. Many people think this is counterintuitive. There's something strange going on, that when the company's financial condition deteriorates, you get a credit in the income statement. So we look into this. The research questions that we actually address in the study are whether the effect of credit risk changes on equity returns are mitigated by leverage. That is, when credit risk changes, equity returns change. When companies in trouble, equity returns go down. But is that decrease, for example, less pronounced when the company has more debt? So the debt holders share in that decrease, reduce the decrease as it relates to the equity holders. And then would net income differ? How would net income differ, or profit or loss, if fair values of debt were recognized? So regarding the first question, what we do is we estimate the relation between equity returns and the change in credit risk and interact this with leverage to see how leverage affects things. We also estimate the change in debt value by looking at the financial statement disclosures of the maturities of debt, going how cash payments due next 5 years, 5 years, 5 years, discount them at the beginning of the year rate, commensurate with the credit risk at the beginning of the year, then again at the discount rate commensurate with credit risk at the end of the year, and see how that number changes. We then also partition the change in credit risk into change in expected asset cash flows and risk. In terms of findings, we find, in fact, that equity returns are less negative when credit risk increases when the company has more debt. This is as predicted. This is actually consistent with Merton's model of equity and debt values. We find this for most credit risk levels, not just the lowest. We know from theory that the effect is biggest when the company is really in financial trouble. But the question is, can you even detect it when they're not in financial distress? And the answer is yes. We find it across the spectrum, and we find it's attributable to cash flow and risk changes. So this confirms that equity holders gain when credit risk increases. That the counterintuitive bit is actually an economic fact. Regarding the second question as to how net income would differ if fair value of debt were recognized, here we actually invert the Merton model. Merton provides this valuation model. And we invert it to get estimates of asset values and estimates of liability values, things that we don't observe. And then we restate net income, first to reflect all changes in fair values, and then, secondly, only changes in debt fair values, because that's all we're talking about. We're not talking about changing the accounting for everything else. And what do we find? We find that when we do all changes in value, as one would expect, that decreases income for companies that have been downgraded, companies whose credit risk has increased. And the opposite for upgrades. That tells us really that the model is working. When the company's in distress, the net effect is negative. Also consistent with what we would expect when we only recognize debt value changes, because we're only recognizing the offsetting piece, there's increases income for downgrade firms and the opposite for upgrade firms. That is the anomalous effect that people are concerned about. But importantly, we also find that the recognized asset write-down, so when the company is in trouble, we write down assets. And the question becomes, are those write-downs big enough to absorb this credit? And the answer is yes. So recognized asset write-downs seem to exceed debt value gains for most firms. This tells us, our interpretation is, that the concerns about anomalous effects are not unwarranted, because we don't recognize all assets, we don't write all assets up, and therefore we can't write them down when things go bad. But it's not nearly as pervasive as people thought. The next example has to do with revaluations of fixed assets and future firm performance. And these examples that I'm giving you, I'll give you different research designs, so it's not that there's one research method that researchers use to answer all these questions. This is joint work with David Abudi, University of California, Los Angeles, and Ron Kasnick, a colleague of mine at Stanford. The motivating questions here are asset revaluation amounts reliable estimates of asset fair values? That's the question we'd like to know the answer to. And then, do managers exercise their discretion so as to render the fair value estimates unreliable? That is one of the concerns about fair value. The question that we actually address in the paper are, do upward asset revaluations explain changes in future operating performance? Operating performance being future operating cash flows and future operating income. And the notion is, if they do, then they must be reflecting part of the value of the asset. Otherwise, if they were totally unreliable, we would not detect a relation. Likewise, if managers were playing games with these numbers, managing these numbers, we would not detect this relation. In this study, we look at UK firms with upward asset revaluations, and we look for an incremental explanatory power and a regression of changes in realized future performance, so increases in operating income or operating cash flows 1, 2, 3 years ahead, and a revaluation amount and some control variables. We also look at prices and returns, which is the research design from the study I told you a moment ago, but that's as a triangulation effect, not the main part of the paper. And we permit these relations to vary with the debt-to-equity ratio because we believe one reason that managers might be managing these numbers is to meet debt covenants. What we find is revaluations are significantly associated with changes in future operating performance, both future operating income and operating cash flows, 1, 2, 3 years ahead. Revaluation balances are associated with share prices, and the increments are with associated returns. It is less positive for higher debt-to-equity firms, so we have evidence. We interpret this as evidence that managers are managing the numbers a bit, but not enough to reduce the overall relation. So the interpretation from this study is fair values of fixed assets are reliable as reflected in future operating performance. Changes in fair values are relevant to investors and reflect timely changes in asset values. If it wasn't happening at the right time, we wouldn't find a relation either. And again, we find evidence of management discretion, but the effects don't seem to eliminate the relevance or reliability of the numbers. So what have we learned from fair value research taken as a whole? Those are just two examples. This is a very large, large literature, and I'm going to oversimplify here to give you some takeaways. But just about everywhere we look, as a matter of fact, I can't think of anywhere that this isn't true, we find that fair values are relevant and reliable enough to be reflected in investors' valuations. We look everywhere we look, financial instruments, tangible assets, intangible assets like brands, the evidence is fairly consistent. We do find that the reliability of fair values can be eroded by estimation error, particularly in the income statement, because you're taking the difference between two estimates and therefore sort of doubling up on the error. Everywhere we look also, we find evidence of management exercising discretion in coming up with fair value estimates, no question about it, but it's never enough to override the implication from the first bullet. And we find the changes in fair value of liabilities can be important to investors. I put that in because of the last paper I showed you. There are lots of questions open for research on fair values, many questions. Some of them are whether we can measure fair values reliably. That's the big question. We have to estimate these fair values. Can we do it well enough, whatever that means, to put it in financial statements? Now, these are motivating questions, so the researchers in the room have to take these questions and figure out how to craft a research design to address them. But these are the motivating questions. Is fair value the right measurement objective? If it is it the right measurement objective for all assets and all liabilities, or only some? If only some, which ones? And if not fair value, then what? It's a huge open question that we don't have the answer to. What information do investors need about fair values? Fair value is a point estimate. Do they need some more information about the distribution of these estimates? Does recognition or disclosure matter? Companies seem to be happy, often putting numbers in the financial statement notes, not so happy about recognizing them. Why does this matter? Are concerns about earnings volatility legitimate? Too much earnings volatility. What is it? Why is it a problem? What are the effects of management discretion in determining fair values? We know it's there, we find it, but what are the implications of that? How will the use of more fair values affect investor or management behavior? People say, well, manage what you measure. If we measure by fair value, then this is going to change the way people behave. And that's a question. What are the implications of incorporating more expectations about the future into financial statements today? In particular, what does profit or loss mean in such a world? It's going to be different. It would be different from profit or loss the way we do it today, but we need to understand exactly what it means, and would it be better for investors or not as good, and why? Now I'd like to turn to issues related to the globalization of financial reporting. It's another huge area of research, and it is growing. Just to remind you, the ISB's vision, as John said, I have spent my time at the ISB, so I think about globalization in these terms. But the vision for the ISB is to have a single set of high-quality global standards that are used in the world's capital markets. That's the ideal. And why is this? Why do we set this as the vision? The most important reason is we want to improve the functioning of global capital markets. We think if we have a single set of high-quality standards, we can improve the functioning of global capital markets. And improve means increase comparability across firms, thereby reducing information processing costs, the costs that analysts and other users of financial statements incur to try to process the information in financial reports. For many countries, it improved the quality of information, depending on where the prior standard stood. It also means decreasing the costs of preparing financial statements, particularly for large multinational firms who have been preparing financial statements using a variety of sets of standards. Also, it reduces information risk and thereby cost of capital. Information risk is the risk that users of financial statements assess because they know they don't quite understand those financial statements. They don't know what a data is about them, but they know they don't understand, and therefore they command a risk premium, and that increases cost of capital. There's a large and rapidly growing literature in globalization of financial reporting. The whole IFRS experiment, if you will, has provided a lot of interest, a lot of data for researchers to deal with. I'm going to give you two examples of studies here. The first is the market reaction to the adoption of IFRS in Europe, and this is joint with Chris Armstrong, who's at the Wharton School. Alan Jagelinzer is a colleague of mine at Stanford, and Eddie Riedel is at the Harvard Business School. The motivating questions here are, did investors perceive net benefits to the IFRS adoption in Europe? It's a question many of us would like to know the answer to. And if there were benefits, did it come from convergence? Did it come from the fact that all of a sudden all these countries in Europe and companies were using the same standards? Or did it come from increases in the quality of the information that came out? Again, motivating questions. Our paper does not answer these questions completely, but we like to think we provide some evidence on this paper. The research questions that we address are, did the European market react positively to events that increased the likelihood of IFRS adoption and react negatively to events that decreased this likelihood? The notion is, events happened that increased the likelihood of adoption and the stock market reacted positively, that suggests that investors are assessing net benefits. We also look to see whether there were differences across firms depending on their pre-adoption information environment to get at this notion of whether it's quality or convergence. Research design, we look at all European firms. We look at the market reaction, three-day market reaction to 16 events between 2002 and 2005, regulatory events, that were part of the process of Europe adopting international financial reporting standards. 13 of the events increased the likelihood, 3 decreased the likelihood. So for example, we begin in March of 2002 when Parliament passed the resolution that all EU companies would use IFRS in 2005. We ended in November 2005 when the EC endorsed the fair value option, just because we had a cutoff date. One of my favorite events is when Jacques Chirac wrote a letter to Romano Prodi, President of the Commission, telling him that if Europe adopted IAS 39, it would be harmful to the European national interest. There was a negative market reaction on that day. We also look at differences for firms with different pre-adoption information environments, banks, because they were at the heart of the controversy over financial instruments, different information asymmetry, differences across countries in enforcement and implementation. What do we find? We find a significant positive overall reaction to the events increasing the likelihood of IFRS adoption. We find that the reaction was incrementally negative for firms in code law countries. Prior research tells us that investors in code law countries are concerned about enforcement and implementation. So this is consistent with investors in those countries being less excited about the change. We find it's incrementally positive for firms that had lower quality pre-adoption information environments, which is more pronounced for banks, and firms with higher pre-adoption information asymmetry. So these findings are consistent with investors having a higher positive reaction when it's likely that the change, when they are assessing the change to increase the quality of the information that they're getting. However, we also find a positive reaction, incremental positive reaction, for firms with high-quality pre-adoption information environments. And we interpret this finding as telling us that this must be about convergence. If they already have high-quality environments, then increasing quality is probably not what was causing the reaction. Therefore, there has to be benefits from convergence as well. So the interpretation, we interpret it as investors perceiving net benefits to the IFRS adoption in Europe, investors being concerned about enforcement of the standards, and net benefits associated with both increased quality and increased convergence. The last example that I'm going to give you tonight has to do with the issue close to my heart, being an American, is issue around whether the U.S. will adopt IFRS. And one of the questions there has to do with whether U.S. GAAP-based financial information is comparable to IFRS-based financial information. This is a working paper, so it's not yet published, by Wayne Landsman and Mark Lang at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Chris Williams at the University of Michigan. The motivating questions here are pretty simple. It's in the title. Are IAS-based accounting amounts comparable to those based on U.S. GAAP? And whether they are or they aren't, can we see evidence that comparability has increased in a variety of dimensions that I'll tell you about? These are very difficult questions, difficult for researchers to operationalize, but the way we do it is we ask whether there are differences in what we call value relevance, so the association between net income and shareholders' equity, the relationship between that and stock prices and returns, whether that is the same. So whether the accounting numbers explain as much of prices and returns based on IFRS as they do based on US GAAP. And then we also look at the correlation of net income under US GAAP and net income under IFRS to see how highly they're correlated. To get at whether comparability has increased, we look to see whether the differences are smaller now than before IAS adoption and in more recent years. And because of this code law, common law notion that I mentioned before, that's replete in the literature, common in the literature, we ask whether the differences are more pronounced for IAS firms in code law or common law countries. In terms of research design, as I said, we look at value relevance, which is the explanatory power of actually four measures: price, stock price, for on book value of equity and earnings, stock returns on earnings and change in earnings, so one's a levels, the other's a change, annual change. And then we separate the earnings and returns relations for good news and bad news to see whether they're the same. Net income correlation, we look both at the coefficient and the explanatory power of regression of IAS net income on US net income. We match IAS firms and US firms to try to control for underlying economics, and then we also include controls in the design for country, industry, share price differences, and everything else we can possibly think of. We look at before and after the IAS firms adopt IAS. We also look at earlier and later sample years, and then a code and common law origins. We find that there are differences between IAS and US firms. Value relevance is higher for US firms than it is for IAS firms. So that tells us we're not comparable yet. But we find that this difference has decreased after the firms adopted IFRS. So they're more comparable under IFRS than they were under their domestic GAAP. They're more comparable for IAS adoption and sample years after 2005 than they were before. And they're closer for firms in common law countries than code law countries. Net income correlations are very similar. The coefficient explanatory power are higher after the IAS firms adopt IAS, so again, evidence of more comparability. Coefficient explanatory power are higher after they adopt IFRS for both code and common law. Code law countries increased more, which is an indication that they had further to go. And then we also find something similar for adoption years and sample years after 2005. So we interpret these findings as saying at the time of our study, US GAAP-based amounts and IAS GAAP-based amounts are not fully comparable, but comparability with IAS is higher than it was with non-US domestic standards, and the comparability has been increasing over time, which suggests to us that the widespread application of IAS by non-US firms and convergence efforts have enhanced comparability with US firms, but differences still remain. There are some big takeaways from globalization research so far, and as I told you, this is a huge literature and getting bigger every day. But so far what we know is that improved disclosure and financial statement transparency can reduce the cost of capital. So this is one of the things that we thought would be a benefit to capital markets. Academic research is bearing this out. We also know that global harmonization can have beneficial capital market effects. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but there's evidence that it certainly can, particularly for small countries. The study I just showed you, that's not the only one that comes to the conclusion that investors viewed IFRS adoption in Europe positively. Large literature looking at comparing quality of accounting amounts finds that IAS higher quality than non-US GAAP, comparable in quality in US GAAP in many countries, although not by US firms. Again, comparability with US GAAP is increasing. We also find that standards are a necessary condition but not sufficient. The ISB can write whatever standards it wants. The standards could be identical between the IFRS and any other standard you want to talk about, US GAAP, but that's not sufficient because actually many of the players in this room are involved in taking those standards and turning them into numbers that are reported in the financial statements. Companies prepare the numbers, make their own interpretations. Auditors audit the numbers, make their own interpretations and enforcement. Regulators enforce them. All of the players have a part to play. Quality of the resulting financial statement information, the numbers that are in the financial statements, depends on the incentives of managers and auditors. Again, these are all findings from more than one research study. We also know that cultures change slowly, not by fiat. So just telling people to change their way they think about financial reporting doesn't automatically mean they're going to do it. It takes time for them to understand what's going on and make the changes as they go by. This last one is a paper that I really like because it reveals my bias, but this is an analytical paper that in analytical papers, you come up with equilibria, and sometimes you get more than one equilibria from the same model, and there's no reason to prefer one equilibrium over another. And this study shows how with countries that have very similar economic environments can end up in very different financial reporting places just because there's two equilibria in the model. But you change things just a little bit, and one of the equilibrium pops over to the other one. And I like it because it says we didn't end up with different standards, or necessarily end up with different standards around the world because we're so fundamentally different. It could be just that we weren't talking to each other, and maybe it's easier to bring us together than many people think. Like fair value, there are lots of questions for research in globalization. Does it really reduce the cost of capital? Again, there are lots of studies out there tackling this question. Cost of capital is unobservable. It's very difficult to get your arms around. And so we need lots of studies, but I don't think we've quite got the definitive answer here. Does it facilitate allocation of capital? Cross-border trading, that's part of the objective. Does it reduce home bias in investing? We know from the finance literature that investors are biased towards investing in their home country. We also know from finance that if you do that, you're bearing more risk than you should bear. Everyone should hold the market portfolio. Question is part of the reason for home bias that people understand financial statements from their home country and not other countries? Can we remove the impediments to global standards? There's a whole large literature that talks a lot about how difficult it is, how things cannot ever be the same because we're different people, different institutions. But can we remove these impediments? Which ones are the most important? Overall, does IFRS application result in higher quality financial reporting? Again, quality is in the eye of the beholder. It's difficult to operationalize, but the academics are trying to sort this question out. And what are the costs and benefits of globalization? There are costs. You all experience them. Whenever you make a change, there are costs, but we believe there's benefits as well. Do the benefits outweigh the costs? Before I close, just a word about the financial crisis. Not a lot, but it's on everyone's mind. The one thing I want to say is that it's not the fault of fair value accounting. I don't think any of us in this room should take the blame for the current financial crisis. We're just the messenger. The accountants are just the messenger. I think everybody looks around. Values of assets went down. We're just telling it like it is. So don't shoot the messenger. However, there has been tremendous pressure to reduce the transparency of financial reporting and the independence of standard setting as a result of the financial crisis. Particularly bank regulators and others have tried to say that we can't let accounting tell it like it is. We have to be careful because look what happened when we told it like it was. The G20 declaration from the financial crisis actually supports high quality, transparent global standards set by independent standard setters. So that was very, very important. Hopefully that their declaration will help offset some of this pressure. The financial crisis, I think, also has increased the focus on convergence around the world, but particularly between the US and IFRS. It is just not, we all realize now we live in a single global world and that we need to have the same financial reporting or we're going to end up going to the lowest common denominator. But regardless, it is a challenging time for all involved in financial reporting. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. So just in conclusion, there are many open questions for research. That's great news for the academics in the crowd, not such great news for standard setters and other accountants. It's almost embarrassing when you tell non-accountants that we don't know what revenue is. 500 years we've been putting revenue at the top of the income statement. And yet the FASB and the IASB have been debating what revenue is for about 5 years now. But it's great for researchers because we have lots of work to do. There are many possible research designs that can make research relevant to standard setting. I gave you four examples, four completely different research designs. I think they all speak to, provide input to a standard setting issue. The key for researchers really is to craft a research design that links the research question to the motivating question so that standard setters and others can see how that research provides input to structures thinking about a particular aspect of the question. Can't answer the question, what should the standard be, but provide input. It's always nice for a researcher to be able to have a double impact and research that contributes both to academic literature, the academic research, and to standard setting, in my view, is what you get. You get two bangs for the buck, so it's worth the extra time and effort to do it. And standard setters need all the help they can get. And academic research really can help resolve many of the nettlesome issues that standard setters face. And I think research has a central role to play in shaping global financial reporting. The slate is open, blank, and ready for our collective input. Thank you very, very much.
Well, I have to thank you for a wonderful lecture. And certainly consistent with the objectives of of this particular research lecture. We have some time for some questions. We have roving mics, etc., somewhere there. Does anyone have any questions of Mary as such? Ah, up there.
Hi, Brian Crofts from Fair Work Australia. You made the comment there that standards are a beginning but not enough. Are you talking there about the need for ethics, or are you talking something beyond that?
I'm talking about all of it. Standards, the ISB, for example, writes a set of standards and then puts them out into the world. People read those words, interpret them the way they think is best, but to get comparable numbers out the other end in the financial statements, the standards alone are not enough. We have to have people reading the words the same way, understanding what is meant, consistent in auditing, enforcement, implementation, all of those things have to happen before the output is high quality and comparable. Ethics may be part of that as well.
Other questions? Ah, oh, Kevin.
The unusual.
Stephen, Kevin.
You said fair value is an exit price, and then you said it doesn't matter whether it's an entry or an exit price, and you had a little paragraph there. Could you help me understand the significance of that commentary against the debate on IAS 37 now, and why some people seem to be keen on a fulfillment value and other people are keen on an exit price?
The point I was trying to make is that within fair value, the way fair value is defined, if you take away transaction costs, we're not talking about entry value and exit value as being different things. That doesn't mean there aren't such things that people think of as entry and exit and might want to use those different approaches to measure things. Just within fair value, there's not entry and exit for the same item on the same day in the same market is the same. We're taking transaction costs out. I think in your example, you're not talking about a transaction cost different. You're talking about a different concept of what it is we're trying to measure. So what I was trying to explain was the way the ISB is defining the term fair value. That doesn't mean that there isn't another measurement method that might be used in some circumstance that had a different characteristic. Does that help?
Any other questions? Keith.
It's Keith Alfredson. I found your comments about the US GAAP and comparing with IFRS quite fascinating, in that some people seem to believe the US are shifting towards IFRS. I don't know where they are or there aren't, but I think it comes to the other question that Australia had a battle with, and that is convergence the answer? That is, you somehow converge to international standards, or in the end, do you have to adopt them? In other words, you adopt the standards and get there and stop the messing around. And I just wondered, what are your views on where America is going, the US is going, and this question of convergence and adoption?
Well, I think you're asking me a question more from my experience as a standard setter as opposed to a researcher. In the study that I talked about, we came to the conclusion that they're not comparable yet. And then you could ask the question, well, is that just a matter of time as the convergence process of the two boards continues, or will there always be a difference? Because with convergence, you never seem to get there. I guess my personal view is the latter. I think you never seem to get there with convergence. Because even though now speaking from my standard setter experience now as opposed to researcher, that even if when you have the same standard, you have different effective dates and different implementation and a few legacy differences here or there. And many times, those differences persist for a very long time. Think of a business combination. Right? If we don't have the same implementation date, effective date, for a business combination standard, we didn't, those numbers are going to be different in financial statements for years and years and years. So when people think about convergence, they say, well, you came to the same answer. You come to the same answer, and therefore you're converged. But the numbers aren't converged because we didn't come together on all of the details or some of the legacy differences in other standards. So my personal view, it sounds from your question that I think I agree with you. At some point, you just have to adopt and be done with it because otherwise you just keep going, and maybe you're getting closer and closer, but you never quite get there. Obviously, the time period of the study that I talked about stopped at a particular date a year or two ago. We haven't played it all out to the future yet.
Got one up the back. Yes.
Yeah. In some of the research that you were talking about, you talked about the impact of the financial markets within Europe and how they were impacted on certain statements that were made. And I'm just wondering how educated a market is to rely on their movement. Is there a possibility that you're going to get a major player that is going to make a movement and then you're going to get an impact where people are just following like sheep and that can cause that impact to be exacerbated rather than it being purely what the impact of that should be? And also, how do you measure what the media's impact is of passing across a message to educate somebody? I mean, when I was growing up and we did university, we talked about classic laissez-faire economics, but in the real world, that doesn't exist. How do you account for that?
Okay, so there were two questions. I'm not sure I understood the second question, so keep the microphone. I may ask you to repeat it. The first question was about the assumption we make about the markets when we use stock prices and returns. And I think the answer is that we have a lot of research, US, here, Europe, many of the developed markets around the world, that says even though markets are not perfectly efficient, they are very close. And therefore, you can use stock prices and returns as a benchmark to get assessments for what investors think. Right. If you noted the way I interpreted that study was say investors perceive net benefits. Now I didn't say whether they were right or wrong, but they're voting with their money, their vote instead of their feet or their hands. They're voting with their cash, and whether they're doing it because they're crazy or not crazy, I don't know. We have a lot of academic research that says markets are very efficient, and therefore it's not crazy to rely on these numbers in the developed markets. But having said that, we're also careful to say this is what investors believe. My view, you can send a survey and ask them. That's one way to find out what they believe. And the other way is to look at their actions. And as a personal, my personal research choice is to look at their actions because they had to put money on the line. And I'm inferring from their collective investment decisions, not just one player. One player doesn't move the European stock market. Lots of them do. So you're looking at their collective assessments when you're looking at those prices. Now, I didn't quite understand the second question.
In relation to statements that are made, I mean, you spoke about President Chirac and the statement that he made about IFRS and its effect on Europe. The media has a role to play, obviously, in relaying of a message and how it thinks a market may interpret that. Is there any way to account for that, or do you, again, just rely on what investors are doing with their money and that gives you your answer?
It's really, for me and in my research, it's the latter, because I don't try to second guess it. I don't wonder about where investors are developing these perceptions. As I said, it's a way to figure out what investors are thinking, what their collective assessment is. And we know from research that if you look at the collective assessment through a stock market price, a price formation, that you really are getting a consensus belief. So it's not a one-off kind of thing. And these dates, many of them we knew the dates from regulatory events, but we also did a search of all the news wires. That's how you come up with dates for events, because you expect the market to react on news, on the major news wires. So when it's picked up, you say, well, how are investors interpreting that information?
Okay. We have time for one more, I think. Up here, yeah.
Mary, one of the things that I've noticed, certainly in my role at the National Institute of Accountants over the past few years, is the focus of people in accounting practice and those people that are asked to think about their investment decisions for retirement, that is, through superannuation or pension plans, is that there appears to be a tension between the expectation of policymakers on these individuals to think about their future retirement and to assess the information they're getting, and also the way in which the framework defines understandability, that is, the framework assumes a very thin layer of people, or a very small group of people, is going to be able to understand what's produced. Are you aware of any research that's looking at how the framework defines understandability and whether it needs to be looked at in a bit more detail and perhaps revised?
So that's a great question. And there is some behavioral research or experimental research that looks at how different types of investors react in a controlled setting. It's very difficult in a market to figure out who the marginal investor is, who is that person setting the price, and what are the characteristics of that person. So it's very difficult in that setting. But there is some research in experimental settings that see whether trained accountants, like many of you in this room, managers, partners at accounting firms versus MBA students who've had accounting or not had accounting, and they look at whether they process information the same way. So there is some evidence, of course, that different types of people have different levels of expertise. We know that, it sort of makes sense that would be the case. And I think what's happened with the framework is that you have to have some target. You have to have some type of user in mind. Otherwise, you don't know what information that kind of person needs. You can't have a set of financial statements that gives information only for the very, very most sophisticated, and you don't want to acquire all the information, explain things for people who've never read an accounting standard. So you're right. The framework takes a view that users of financial statements have to be reasonably knowledgeable in business and accounting and are willing to study the information with some diligence. And that's, you know, it's not my mother-in-law, but it's, I don't think she sets prices in the stock market either. I don't feel too bad that we're not writing accounting standards for her level of understanding. But that is it's just a decision that has to be made, and that was under debate when the boards issued the exposure draft, the discussion paper, the exposure draft of the first two chapters of the framework to talk about what users should be the target. And I think that was what was proposed and got comments back, and I believe that's where they're going to end up. But I think it's mostly you just have to decide what it is, what the characteristics are, so you know what it is you're trying to do. And that doesn't make it right or wrong. It just is what it is.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Mary. I'd just like to call on Professor Richard Petty from the CPA Australia to make a few comments here, or and we're going to present a medal apparently to you.
Oh, wow. Can you stand aside?
Thank you, John. As President of CPA Australia, I'd like to warmly thank you for being here tonight. CPA Australia is delighted to have once again partnered with the University of Melbourne to present the annual research lecture, which is the oldest continuous research lecture anywhere in the world. The annual research lecture is now in its 70th year, which is a tremendous milestone. And I don't know that anyone here would have been present at the first lecture 70 years ago, but I'd be most pleased to be proved incorrect on that point. No hands. Okay. Since its origins in 1940, the lecture has provided a platform to showcase the latest thinking in accounting and finance, and has done a fantastic job, we think, in doing that. Tonight's lecture was another important contribution to the pursuit of excellence in accounting, and Professor Barth's technical expertise and her exposure to accounting standards and the development of accounting standards made for a very interesting lecture. And I'm pleased to let you know, and greatly comforted also, Mary, to let you know that CPA Australia's official policy on a whole range of issues, including fair value accounting, is in direct concordance with your conclusions here and some of the opinions that you expressed in your lecture. So it's great to have an endorsement from our friends in America and our friends at Stanford University and our friend presenting here tonight. So on behalf of CPA Australia and in the University of Melbourne, I'd like to once again thank Professor Mary Barth for her insights this evening and for giving such a great lecture. Please join with me in once more thanking Professor Barth. And I'd now like to invite Professor John Lyon to present Professor Barth with the University Medal.